If you're receiving this transmission, then this operation is a success. Dr. Nick and the hot Aussie chick are in the house and ready to dissect blackjack, poker, and everything in between.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are, whatever time it is. You're with Dr. Nick.
And the hot Aussie chick, and...
Apparently,
we have our special guest.
Yes, we have another doctor in the house, Dr. Alan Schoonmaker. Is that how it is, Alan?
Schoonmaker. You've been getting it wrong for years, sir.
Well...
Get it right.
I told him this earlier.
He's not very bright. What can we do?
I'm as bright as a black light, as I always
say. That's right.
So, Dr. Alan Schoonmaker is the author of several books, most of them on poker.
Several.
More than three.
That's three. Goodness me.
Well, his most popular book is, or I guess the one he's most well known for, is The Psychology of Poker, which makes sense because, Al, you are a PhD in psychology.
Yes, sir.
Yes, and why don't you give us a little bit of background of where you went to school and how many scores of years ago you graduated?
It was just before they opened Harvard University.
Oh, I see.
Okay. No, I went to...
Is that true?
No. Harvard University was started in the 16th century, and I'm old, but I ain't quite that old. I went to the University of California, Berkeley, and I went on from... After I got my degree there, I joined the faculty at UCLA, and shortly after that, I joined the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University, where I was in the business school, and then I had a research fellowship at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, which is the oldest Catholic university in the world.
So it's fair to say that Alan knows his stuff.
Sometimes.
Indeed.
And what? How old are you now, Alan? 82, 3, 7?
What? How old am I?
Age does not matter.
I'm 81. Going on 114.
I see. And you've been playing poker for the better part of what, 55, 60 years?
About 67 years.
Wow.
In which case, if you combine poker and psychology into a book made by this man, obviously it's going to be brilliant.
Yeah, Alan actually got me a copy of it, and it was like $24.95 on the sticker price, and then he signed it, and then immediately went down in value.
Right. It went down in value, but what the hell?
No, actually, it's got some great insights into poker strategies, and the most interesting aspect that I found about his book is the profiling of players.
And that's something that is very interesting.
And it's, you know, it works well, Alan. You've been playing for a long time now. The most of your play experience has been with limit. So would you say, with limit games, would you say that your profiling is based on limit, and are those observations transferable to no limit games as well, which seems to be the most popular game right now?
They're transferable, but not as well as I would like. The real problem with no limit as compared to limit is that you have much less information about your opponents. You see so few showdowns in poker that you really don't know what the other guy did. If I play poker, limit poker, for 3 hours with a bunch of people, I will almost certainly have seen him show down some hands, and I'll realize that he had pocket aces or ace jack off suit or trash. But in no limit, it is not at all unusual after 3 hours to have never seen or seen only one or two of the hands that the person shown down. So you're making an inference about his play, but you really don't know what he had.
With the advent of televised poker,
oh yes,
where you can see the hands, you can see the hole cards that the players have, what kind of inferences can you make on them?
Oh, I got an interesting story about that. When they first started that, Russ Hamilton, who later became notoriously hated, was talking to the Wednesday Poker Discussion Group, which I was in very actively for a long time, and he said, you know, I really don't like the whole idea of these cameras. I like the money, of course, But I don't want people to know that I will make plays with 9-7 offsuit and that I'll slow play aces to the turn. I don't want people to know that about me. And that information, I have to tell you, isn't nearly as valuable as you would think it is, because experts are extraordinarily different from you and me. They are so good at reading each other. They play head games, and they, how should I say, the mere fact that Tom Dwan can get away with something doesn't mean that Al Schoonmaker can.
And it's
right. And the real problem with televised poker is that if you, as my friend Lou Krieger once said, if you learn how to play by watching television, you're learning a lot of bad things. Right. And the reason is, well, first of all, they're expert players, and you're not playing experts. And second, the shows are highly edited. And so all you're seeing are the dramatic hands. It's dramatic as hell when Tom Dwan has nothing on the flop, floats, and makes a check raise bluff on the turn to take the hand down. But for all you know, that's the only hand he's played. Or he may play 14 hands between now and then.
Right.
And you just don't know how people really play, what really happens. What's the typical happening in an all-limit game?
Fold.
Raise and take it. Raise and take it.
Raise and take it.
Raise and take it. And that goes on, but that's...
Impressive.
Yeah, but that's most of the hands go down that way, but it's boring as hell to watch. Right. So to make it exciting, they want to show you when somebody floats the flop and makes a small raise on a turn and shoves all in on the river when he flopped top set and he still got the stone cold nuts.
Yeah, I've been playing with Alan for a few months now. Just playing low limit games, and poker is notoriously boring. And what Alan told me very early on, he says your most important hand or your most important action is folding after your first two cards, because you know that's what you're going to be doing most often.
Yep.
And
Alan is correct.
And one of speaking of like professionals, Alan's Psychology of Poker was the number one book for a certain publisher until the original madman himself, Gus Hansen, knocked him off the that top list.
For which I will never forgive Gus, even though he's a hell of a lot better player than I'll ever be.
Yeah.
Hold on. I don't understand.
Well,
now, if I don't understand.
Alan's book was the best-selling book for a certain publisher. What was the publisher? Was it
Kensington? I wrote a book called Your Worst Poker. Your Worst Poker Enemy, and I believe, I'm not sure, but I believe it was outselling any of their other poker books. And then Gus came along and beat the crap out of me.
Yeah.
Every hand revealed is an amazing. I'm halfway through it. And the insights are just insane. And some people credit that, or some people think that that actually caused a major downturn in Gus Hansen's game.
Well,
I don't think so.
Well, I'm coming back to the point that Russ Hamilton made. You really don't want people to know how well you play. I got to give you a little insight onto that. I've had any number of people criticize me because I visibly take a lot of notes right at the table. And people say, hey, Al, why are you doing that? Real players don't do that. And I say, well, is Dan Harrington a real player? And they say, yeah, he's Hall of Fame. And I quote something like page 197 or something like that, in which he points out that top players have hundreds of pages of notes on each other. They watch each other's telecasts. They record how to play. They watch their body language. They take all of these notes because at a critical time, they want to know more about them than they know about me. All right?
And believe it or not, the same applies online.
Oh, gosh, yes.
People, make your notes.
Well, online, you have all these wonderful devices for keeping track of notes.
Player Tracker for one of them.
Player Tracker, Hold'em Manager. And the really serious online players have extraordinarily detailed notes about each other with a heads-up display, so that not only do they have the notes, but they have them instantly available.
As well as a hand history of that particular player.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Now, would you say...
Which is why the likes of Isildur, when he came along and started crushing the nosebleeds, that everyone was like, what do we do? What do we do? And he was killing it because no one had notes on him. No one even knew who he was.
Right. That was an astonishing thing with Isildur. Nobody even knew who he was. We found out he was some 19-year-old, and then he played Brian Hastings of Cornell University, who beat him for several million dollars. You know, at one time Isildur simultaneously played Tom Dwan, Patrick Antonius, and Phil Ivey, and kicked the crap out of all three of them simultaneously. And he was playing two different games. He was playing Putnam and Omaha with one and Hold'em with us. And he kicked the crap out of three of the best players in the world simultaneously. And then 6 months later, he was busted.
Let me ask you this, Alan.
Because they worked him out, right? They got notes.
Well, not only that, apparently there was some very questionable information about him that they were sharing during the play. Somebody was apparently coaching. I heard that. I haven't got the details on it. But whenever you get that much money involved, the danger of cheating is very significant.
Let me ask you this, Alan, with the note-taking and the analytics, would you say that poker itself has, at least in the online environment, and I've heard some of the veterans talk about this, like a Doyle Brunson, where like 19, 20, 21-year-old kids are playing a million hands before they even enter the World Series of Poker. Do you think it's become more of an analytical game where they're making the correct mathematical play in hopes that by playing so many hands, like, for example, some players play 24 tables at a time, that's their objective, is to make money that way just by sheer math and analytics and volume of play?
Yep, it's not just at the poker table, as Nick knows and other people may know. I'm a former business professor, and I've been interested. I used to work on Wall Street, and just recently I was interviewed by Institutional Investor about exactly this issue, and the quants, as they're called, are taking over the Wall Street world with high frequency traders and so on, and your friend Ed Thorpe was right. A dominant figure in this book.
One of the first.
He wrote Beat the Market. Pardon me, Beat the Dealer. Then he wrote Beat the Market.
Now, a lot of those systems are outdated.
Yeah.
Right now,
okay. But well, that's the nature of poker, is that whatever you did last Tuesday, it could be obsolete today. And what these kids have done is they have. You said a million hands before they played. Some of them play a million hands a year.
Yeah.
They have a thing called Poker Stars has a thing called Elite Supernova or something like that.
They did. That was actually terminated.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, and the rebate programs that they got. David, I forget his last name, but of Amaya Gaming, he took a lot of heat. That was one of the things that he got criticized heavily for. The Supernova, and some players that I know cost them like $125,000-$150,000, because they get rebates.
Well, yeah, because they were playing a million hands a year, and that's more hands than I've played in my entire life. And I've been playing 68 years. Well, no, I didn't play for several years when I was, when I first got out of grad school, I had other things to do, like raise kids and make a living and so on. But Doyle has said there are kids out there 21 years old that have played more poker hands than I have. Doyle.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and...
Let's get back to this book, because we kind of got off track, and I want to know about it. I've not read your poker psychology book.
Well, darling, I owe you a copy. I'll even autograph it, even though it'll reduce the value, okay?
Thank you, Alan. Tell me... All of this kind of stuff is in the book, or what are we going to be reading when we grab our copies?
Well, the dominant theme of the psychology of poker was how do you adjust your game to fit the styles of the other players? And so, beautiful. And so there's a grid based upon the management grid of two dimensions, the tightness passive dimension and the aggressive, pardon me, tight, loose, and passive aggressive dimension. So you got the super aggressive, super loose person is the maniac. The super tight, super passive is the rock. He just sits and sits and sits and sits. Then you've got the loose passive, which is absolutely the worst style. That's the person who, the calling station, he calls and calls and calls and calls.
And isn't that fabulous for us, though?
Oh, yes. That's the best of all opponents.
Right.
And then you've got the most effective style in cash games, not tournaments, is unquestionably what we call tight aggressive. I call them stone killers. Those are people who don't play a lot of hands, but do play them very aggressively. And so they lose little money when they've got bad cards, and they win a lot of money when they've got good cards. And those are the most successful cash game players. Now, that's less true for tournaments. In tournaments, as so many people have said, you've got to gamble a lot more because only a few people win. You cannot wait around for aces and kings and ace king. So you got to gamble. So in the tournaments, the generally speaking, the higher the people have to be somewhat looser and, of course, very aggressive. Nobody has ever won a major tournament without being an aggressive player.
Right. No. He does speak truth. I've watched a lot of tournaments, obviously, reporting very closely. And aggression, definitely that's the winner there.
Now, what's interesting to me is the emphasis in that book was on reading other people. And I was getting a lot of email mostly about the book, or I get it on the 2+2 forum where I was active. And most people were more interested in what I had said about your own style. That is, what should you do if you're a tight passive player, a loose aggressive player, or whatever. And I realized that, hey, Alan, you got the wrong focus. Focus on yourself. And that's why I wrote the second book, which was called Your Worst Poker Enemy. And that deals with how we beat ourselves up. We make mistakes, and we continue to make mistakes because we don't look at ourselves. The whole poker world is kind of anti-introceptive. I want to analyze other people. I don't want to look at me.
Well, that's not what the pros do, as you would know.
No.
That makes sense, too, because you know, you're playing yourself as much as you are playing everybody else.
Oh, yes. And I have to tell you, I had some really... Some people got really angry about this. Because they said, nah, I don't want to look at me, I want to look at them. And the real problem you have is that you play a tiny fraction of your hands against any one player. But you and your mindset are in every hand you play. And so the person you most have to understand is you.
Right. And that's why all of the pros, back to talking about stats and, you know, poker trackers and hold'em manager and all the rest of it, many pros, myself included, back in the day when I was, you know, actually doing something, they look through hand statistic after hand statistic. They look at mistakes they've made. They look at patterns that they've made themselves. So I'm glad you've got that book. Glad you've written that book, Alan. That's very important.
Well, not only that, what you find is that poker pros are just like golf pros in that most of them have coaches, either formal coaches that they pay or a buddy system. Pro X gets together with Pro Y and they talk to each other about what they're doing right and wrong. And somebody says, why would you do that? And I say, well, Tiger Woods is the best golfer, or was the best golfer in the world, and he always had a coach. Ted Williams was the best hitter, and he always had a coach. Now, unless you think you're better at poker than Tiger Woods is at golf, then maybe you need one too, buddy.
Very true. It is very true. And a lot of people do group together. Again, I'll refer to online. That's where most of my play has been. You normally have your little Skype buddy up there telling you, you know, well, what did you do that for? Oh, I just saw this. Or how was your play today? So even worlds apart, live tournament and someone's, you know, on the other side of the world on Skype telling you, you know, you definitely had a bad day today. And so, yeah, absolutely, that applies.
Now, that's good, too, because on the other side, after you analyze your own play, and say you decide to fold a hand. Now, a lot of people don't realize this. This is what I learned from Alan, too, is that you have to pay attention when you're not in the hand. That's where a big part of your information is gathered from.
And I forgive my saying this, Nick, but you don't do that well.
I do not. I'm a very social person at the tables, and I try to ease people and get relaxed. But Alan told me that I'm considerably better player when I do focus.
Oh yes. In fact, I deliberately try to get Nick to focus by I say, what mistake did seat 7 just make? And Nick says, what?
Yeah, we gotta remember, sometimes I do get the questions right, and you're impressed by that.
Right. And the reason that we learn more when we're out of the hand is we're more objective. When we're in a hand, we cannot help thinking, boy, I hope a spade hits, or gee whiz, what should I do about, what should I do next? But when we're out of a hand, we can be totally objective, and we can be objective not just about the guy who just bet, but the guy who's to our left who hasn't done anything up until now.
Right.
We can be watching. And I'm going to give away my most important secret. I'm quite serious. The typical person...
thing to do. I'm talking over the top of you just to make sure you're certain.
Okay. The place that people give themselves away is not their eyes or their face. It's their hands. And the reason is very simple. From the time we are children, we are taught to lie with our face and our mouth. Go kiss Aunt Susie. We hate Aunt Susie, but Aunt Susie might give us a cookie. And so we give Aunt Susie a kiss. But people don't pay much attention to what they do with their hands. They really don't.
That's very true. And that applies to many areas of life, such as modeling. Oh, my gosh. You know, the whole hands thing and feet. Not that anyone can see feet at a poker table, but hands in modeling, hands in anything. Where do you put those things? What do you do with them? They're never your focus. You know, you're concentrating in modeling, as an example, on every part of your body. How is your face sitting? How are your teeth? What do your eyes look like? Is your head tilted correctly? And then you've got these hands.
Well, as a matter of fact, Joe Navarro, who's one of the leading experts in the world on body language, he and Mike Carroll both wrote great books that I recommend to everybody, said that the most revealing part of our bodies at the poker table is our feet, but I can't see them, so I've never really commented on the feet. But
right.
A very, very good signal you can get from somebody who's immediately to your right or left is leg jiggling. People who jiggle their legs are having tension problems, all right? And
ironically, I'm jiggling mine now.
Well, my dear, you're also having a little tension right now, as we said before, okay? And it's a way of expressing tension in a socially acceptable way, because we think nobody can see our feet. Right.
Well, I think that anyone who's listening to this will know, because we're going to walk in poker rooms now and we're going to see people looking under the poker tables. They're the ones that have tuned in to Dr. Nick and the Hot Aussie Chick and listened to this valuable information.
Now, one thing that we talked about, Alan, is presence at a poker table. And one thing that, crazy nicknames in poker. One time I called you the Viper, which is completely orthogonal to your personality. And
I resented it immensely.
Yes, you resented it immensely. But I think it's important that you tell people why such, such nicknames or such, agitations are not a good thing for a pro or semi-pro poker player.
Okay. The most important lesson in business or customer relation, I should say, is make people want to do business with you. And so many poker players are obnoxious assholes. I'm very serious. And you don't want to do that. I wrote an article some years ago that quoted a famous a guy who was the editor of the Harvard Business Review called Theodore Levitt. And didn't he become the dean at
he did.
He also became the dean at Harvard Business School. And he wrote several classic articles, but the one that I remember the most is called Marketing Myopia. And it said, we've got to focus our attention on markets. And the example he gave was the airlines, that when the airlines saw that the railroads were attacking their business, what they tried to do was prevent the railroads from taking their business. And he said they were stupid. What they should have been doing was buying railroads, because they were in the transportation business and they knew how to run the transportation business. Pardon me, I got it backwards. The railroads should have done it to the airlines. I got it backwards. When the railroads were losing business to the airlines, they should have bought airlines because they knew how to run transportation.
Right.
And they didn't.
Makes sense.
Okay. The same thing holds true. If you're a poker pro, whether you like it or not, you're in the entertainment business. If people aren't having enough fun to justify the money they're losing, they won't play with you. It's just that simple. I am a reasonably competent player. I'm a reasonable winner. I'm not a great poker player, but people like to play with me because I'm always a gentleman. Always.
Whereas if you were named the Viper, as mentioned previously, that's obviously sounding pretty nasty.
Yeah. And the same thing holds true for a very significant number of players. They're friendly. They sit down. They chat with you. They say, welcome to the table. And there are other people who are just really obnoxious. So, and they criticize somebody. For example, you've got aces. You raise. Somebody calls you with 7-4, and he flops a two pair and beats the hell out of you. Well, the last thing in the world you should do is criticize him for being an idiot for calling you. Because what do you want to do? You want him to fold? You're an 80% success. You got an 80% probability of winning. You want his action. And anything you do to cut off your action is extremely undesirable. When you're nasty to people, three things happen. One is they may leave. Two is they may be so embarrassed by their bad play, they stop acting stupidly. Do you want them to stop acting stupidly? Hell no.
There was a certain hand, Alan, that I told you about. Where I had aces and the guy had 2-4 diamonds.
Yes, and you were furious.
I was, long story short, the guy hit the,
He flushed on the river.
He flushed on the river. It was like a 2-4 game. It was 7-way cap, $10. So the pot was over over $150, okay. Almost $200. But I was furious. But I was more furious at the fact that he was rubbing it in.
Oh, he was obnoxious. There was no question about it.
But conversely, I did get him back, though, didn't I?
Well, he
listen to how smug you sound.
Oh, this was a marvelous hand. Usually, we chop the blinds. I'm on the button. All will fold around to me. I fold. Nick raises with pocket nines. The other guy, three bets with pocket queens. Nick calls. The flop is nine small, small. Nick check raises. He three bets. The turn is the queen. So now it's set over set, and they go to war. The river is the fourth nine, and they start to war, and Nick tries to go all in. And but they say, you can't go all in.
But the reason I tried to go all in, because literally 7-8 minutes before that, the dealer said, if there are two people left on the river, you can push all in. So, again, another thing, don't listen to dealers. Know the rules
right,
first.
Right, right. And so Nick got five or six bets out of him on the river, and, of course, the guy was furious. And so, and Nick was in seventh heaven because he has just shoved it up this guy. Because the guy was really, he was obnoxious when he had won with four deuce against my friend's aces. But both of them were out of line because they both are, quote, semi-pro players. And neither one of them should have been needling each other. They should.
Well, I did not needle him. I stayed quiet. I didn't say, yeah, crack those queens, or like this guy did.
No, okay.
But I was very happy. And yes. then what did he say? What, when you saw him next, what did he say to you, Al?
He said, how's the guy who busted my ace, who made the four nines doing? You know, like, I hope he dropped dead. You know,
the guy was a jerk.
Yeah. But, hey, but there's a lot of jerks
there
around.
There's a lot of jerks out there.
Sir.
There he is.
Well,
Alan.
But wait, years ago, Mason Malmuth wrote that if everybody played well, we would all lose because the house would kill us.
Oh, yeah.
And we make our money only because other people make more mistakes than we do. So we want them to make mistakes.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you said to me, if you play a session of poker and you only make one or two mistakes, you're very happy.
Yes, I cannot recall ever playing more than an hour without making at least one dumb play.
Well, I've played about 2 hours without making a dumb play, but of course I folded every hand.
Well, as long as you fold every hand, well, maybe you should have called a couple of times.
Maybe, just a little bit.
The poker psychology stuff, like, because obviously I'm very interested in it. I started writing poker psychology stuff, not that I'm a psychologist myself, just from stuff I was picking up on. And a lot of the stuff I was writing were for people who would be listening into the show, actually.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know lots of people listening. They're like semi-pros. They're trying to get their name out there. You know, everyone's always looking for sponsorship and whatever
right.
else. So when people are choosing online poker names or poker names, you know, it's back to what we were talking about, would they be in the right to make it a nice name?
Yes.
Rather than an aggressive, attackive name?
Oh, yes.
Choosing something. So now I'm just going to be very selfish here. Choosing something like the Hot Aussie Chick. That works, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, I have a number of women players who have pointed out, and pardon me, not just, forget about my friends. Let's take Annie Duke, who is among the most successful female players.
And some of the most right. disliked.
And if you look at the title of, or the subtitle of one of her books, it includes the word flirted. Right?
Hmm.
And there's no reason why women can't use, quote, feminine wiles for at the poker table. And my dear friend Robin Salisbury tells a lovely story. Robin's a very good looking woman, and she was playing, I think it was 10-20, could have been 15-30, and some guy was disparaging her. I'm not going to leave here as long as you've got any money, babe, or something like that. And she had the great pleasure of seeing him lose a great deal of money because he was underestimating her. You know, I mean, you're just a girl. well, Robin is not just a girl. She happens to be a hell of a good player.
Speaking
but she also happens to be a professional stock trader, a pardon me, options trader.
Oh,
yes. Really. Oh, yeah. Used to be on Wall Street. Very smart lady.
I have a comment about that, about those interchangeable skills that might happen. Recently, Vanessa Spelt, as we all know, retired from poker, and she moved onto the world of, was it hedge fund managing or stock trading or something? Correct. But she's a Yale, is it a Yale trained? A Yale trained attorney. So what type of skills would she have, or what type of skills, being like stockbrokers or traders and poker players, are interchangeable?
Well, the first and most important is excellent mathematical skills. And the ability to discern patterns from what looks like random numbers. I might add, I do not trade, even though I spent a significant amount of time on Wall Street with companies like Drexel Burnham Lombard and Bankers Trust and Wells Fargo and so on. But I dealt only with selling and negotiating deals. But I've been observing them for a long time. And what they have is they have the ability to detect patterns and make predictions. They have extraordinarily good nerves. You cannot possibly survive in the world of trading without having an ability to handle risk in a rational, objective way. And by that I mean you don't love it, you're not doing it for the kick, for the high of taking a chance, as maniacal poker players do, and you're not doing it extraordinarily reluctantly, I've got to do it. You're managing risks. You're looking at them with a high degree of realism. You're brutally realistic about the situation, and you're able to recognize your mistakes very, very quickly. Again, talking about my friend Robin, Robin said that traders have one of the characteristics of poker pros, which is they can get away from mistakes faster. And the dumbest words you'll ever hear in poker are, I've gone this far, I got to go further. No, you don't.
There's no such thing as pot committed.
There shouldn't be. I mean, for example, if the tightest player in the Western Hemisphere just bet into me with four hearts on the board and he just shoved in his stack, my number three flush is going in the toilet, right?
No matter how much you've got in there.
It doesn't matter, right?
Let me ask you this, Alan, though, because this was one of the problems that you see in Wall Street a lot with brokers and traders, is it's not their money.
Yes.
So when poker players, it is their money. So are brokers more likely to be bigger gamblers because there's no downside for them?
Absolutely. In fact, David Sklansky and I wrote a book called Do You See Why? Just the letters, D-U-C-Y. And we talked about that, which is if ever there is an incompatibility between your interests and the person handling your money, be extraordinarily careful or don't do it. And it's one of the really absurdities the last 8 or 10 years with the Fed buying all those toxic assets, is that people who made spectacularly bad deals ended up getting zillion-dollar bonuses,
right,
while the rest of us got screwed.
Now, stockbrokers, that's a great analogy with the stockbrokers and getting screwed. I often get asked, kind of changing gears a little bit, they would try to equate stockbrokers with advantage players. You know, blackjack APs, hole carders.
No, because you're playing your own money.
Right, exactly. Well, that to the point of two. But what I'm talking about is, you know, Ed Thorpe was a great money manager, and they make that false parallel. But when people ask me what profession do you most parallel, I always say a high-skilled defense attorney. And they say, what? Why? And both attorneys and advantage players whether it's blackjack or hole cutters or APs of three card poker, whatever you're doing, you find and exploit loopholes within a given system for your own advantage.
Okay.
Would you say that's a fair assessment, Alan?
Except that there's one absolutely critical difference.
What is that?
Which is, I'm the attorney, you're the client. If I lose, you go to jail and I go home.
That's true.
All right, I'm very serious.
But you're good. But a good attorneys have the reputations of getting exploiting loopholes, right?
But
same with advantage players.
The most successful defense attorneys get far fewer acquittals than they negotiate deals where, if we go to trial, you have an excellent chance of spending life in prison, while I can make a deal that you're going to go in for 12 years with a chance of parole after six or whatever.
Right.
But there's a...
They're skilled negotiators.
Oh, gosh. They're extraordinarily skilled negotiators.
Speaking of negotiating, we're gonna transition. You're trying to put out some new stuff on negotiation.
Guys.
Yes,
Dan. You're ignoring me.
Well, we're not ignoring.
Back to the whole stockbroking thing.
Okay.
You were talking about, they're spending someone else's money, etc. Now, Alan, no doubt you have seen there's lots of people being staked now. There's lots of staking sites. You know, people are backed. People sell percentages of their stuff. Do you think there's the whole psyche behind the play of those people who are being paid into poker tournaments is different to someone who is, playing on their own back?
Absolutely.
Well, similarly, you see a lot of younger females getting sponsored. And these young, attractive women, they're good poker players, no doubt. But all their entry fees are being paid for by their sponsorship. So they're bound to win some tournaments. So how does that affect them?
I honestly don't know.
The bigger players. So, there's people like Mike Matisau. His last World Series of Poker, so last year, he was coming out, he was selling percentages of himself. But do you think that's like a whole game change player? Or, he said that he was doing that, for the fun, for his fans and whatever else. Surely it's got to change your game, right?
Well, it all depends on what you're getting for what you're paying. Let's say, for example, I'll just take a number. Let's take the $10,000 main event. And if I could buy 10% of Mike Matisau for $1,000, I'll give you the money right now, because Mike is obviously a plus EV player. But Mike is not going to sell 10% of himself for $1,000. He's going to sell 10% of himself for $2,500 or $3,000. So generally speaking, the people who back players are in a losing proposition.
So they can lose. They can
they're
lose.
They're paying too much money for what they get. If you're paying a 50 or 75% premium above the ratio of what you're getting, you're probably losing money on an EV basis.
Right. That's right. So, but it is kind of similar, I suppose, to trading, right?
Well, Mike
making stupid decisions.
Well, Mike Matusow is a really interesting guy. In that he once won $1 million at the World Series of Poker, and they said, "What are you going to do with it?" And he said, "Pay off some of my markers." Yeah. Right? Which meant that he owed one hell of a lot of money.
Exactly. And that's common for poker players, too.
Oh, gosh, yes. In fact, one of the things that's absolutely fascinating about tournament players is that you can be very, very high in the poker of the year, player of the year standings, and have a losing year.
Right.
You just,
and they've just changed all of that, by the way.
How?
They've reviewed it all, and they're including World Series of Poker Europe, etc. They've revised the whole player of the year point system.
Oh, yeah. But the thing is, you get points for winning. You don't get points subtracted for losing.
Right.
So if I enter 100 tournaments and win 4 of them, I may have a very high standing, but I could have a very substantial loss.
Right.
And it's no accident that a number of marquee poker players are broke and in debt.
Right.
Let's get to what you were talking about, Nicholas. I want to hear about all of Alan's books. Now, I know I had interviewed Alan last year. Let's hear about Alan, the best of the best.
Well, Alan's got a lot of poker books, but his more recent stuff, and I think you could probably draw some parallels with No Limit, where negotiation. Poker is like a negotiation. Now, one article that Alan and I talked about discussing negotiating, and I don't want to do this, but Alan and I talked about this several times. I think it makes it for a hell of a conversation. Is would you play poker against Donald Trump?
Absolutely not.
And why not?
Because he can read me better than I can read him.
Well, would you say he's one of the best? Well, obviously he's.
I don't even know if he plays poker.
But you're right. But his negotiating skills and his just sheer his sheer talent and his skill set is amazing.
I have to tell you, I did not vote for Trump, even though I'm a Republican, because he frightens me. But that's all part of his shtick. And what Trump has done is an absolutely brilliant job of keeping people off balance. He makes outrageous claims. He uses outrageous language. He tweets in a manner which would be regarded as totally undignified by anybody in this office. And
he hangs up on the Australian Prime Minister.
Yes, he did.
He threatens people. And yet he backs off quickly, and so nobody ever knows where he is. And if he can read me better than I can read him at the poker table, he's doing exactly the same thing at the negotiating table. I think that Trump is an absolutely brilliant negotiator for bargaining type issues. However, he is terrible at creating long-term trusting relationships. And one of the real issues in negotiation is the same as it is in poker, which is you need to adjust your style to fit the situation. And the books on negotiation tend to sell one style and one style only. There's a book called Getting to Yes, which is total unadulterated horseshit. And it's
that's a technical term, right?
Yeah, it's a technical term. Yeah. That he actually.
It's not your book, just to clarify.
Right, no. It's written by allegedly based on research done at Harvard University. And that's no. They actually claim, honest, that their style is an all-purpose strategy that will work whether you're dealing with this hardliner or a softliner, dealing one-on-one or in a multiple-party negotiation, or even dealing with aircraft hijackers. He's got no data, no data at all on that. But the idea that you can sit down and have a win-win discussion with somebody who's threatened to blow you out of the skies is just nonsense. And I might add that when we invaded Kuwait years ago, when we invaded Iraq years ago, one of the authors went on the radio and said we should have sit down and have a friendly conversation with him. Honest. Yeah.
Wow.
And what did Ronald Reagan say about that? He said he could never negotiate because he couldn't anticipate the irrationality of those regimes.
Well, yeah. And now you have the other thing, which is some people say you should always be aggressive. There's a book came out years ago, bestseller, called Winning Through Intimidation. It said just run over everybody. No, sometimes you run over people, sometimes you make nice. And the critical skill in poker and negotiation is to understand what does this situation require and do whatever that situation.
Right. Was that one of the major themes? You read Art of the Deal, I'm sure, years ago by Trump.
Yep.
And what was your four thoughts on that?
My thought was, boy, this guy is smart. And I might add, he admits in his book that he doesn't mind lying. He, for example, he talks about buying the air rights over one of the properties.
Right.
And he said, I knew I couldn't do that. You know, I knew we couldn't. Right. He said we can buy this, and we're not going to disrupt your store operations. Yeah, sure. I mean, come on, you're going to walk through a construction site without getting disrupted. People who are going to go to an upscale store are willing to walk underneath the, you know,
scaffolding.
Dirt. Oh, come on. In fact, I was talking on my phone just by chance. They're fixing the roof on my building and chasing me out of the house.
Right.
You know, construction is a mess.
Yes.
So the book that we're talking about, kind of the book we're talking about, is called what?
Negotiate to Win, Gaining the Psychological Edge, second edition. I published the first edition right about the same time that Donald Trump published The Art of the Deal.
And which one sold better?
I can't remember.
It was close.
Hey. Wait a second. But I got one thing he hasn't got. My book got translated into Indonesian. So take that, Donald.
Excellent.
And yours is very, very more along the lines of poker, right?
No. This was about negotiations.
Right.
Just about negotiations.
But I'm sure
didn't even mention the word poker didn't even appear in that book.
Right. Okay, so we're coming up on the 51-minute mark, and we've had a great...
I just want to hear the list of books. A list of books, geez. Alan, throw them out there. Because, as I said earlier, the people that are going to be listening to our show, or the people that I know that listen to our show, are people that will buy these books and do need these books, in fact. It's not just a matter of, you know, wanting...
They do add to your tool belt for success in the...
All right, well, the first book I wrote was called Anxiety and the Executive. Then I wrote Executive Career Strategy. Then I wrote a Student Survival Manual. Then Selling the Psychological Approach. Then The Psychology of Poker. The Worst Poker Enemy. Your Best Poker Friend. Poker Winners Are Different. How to Beat Small Poker Games. Stay Young, Play Poker. The Poker Party Is Over. What Will You Do Now? I got a couple of others I can't remember.
Like the kill button one.
Oh, yeah. How to beat the kill the hold'em game.
Which I believe is the only book ever written on the subject. Right?
Well, dear, I'm going to send you all the books. I'm going to burden you down with them. You're going to get a sore back.
Well, Danielle's actually going to be in the U.S. At the end of May for about 6-8 weeks.
Wow. We're going to get together.
Yes. Wait,
lots of times.
Yes. Lots of shows. And most importantly, doing a videography for Poker News, which has got to be done by someone, right?
Yes, Danielle has locked down that gig, so she's ready to go. So, in any event, we have talked to Dr. Alan Schoonmaker.
Right.
And I just call him Alan. So.
It's Dr. Allen to you, buddy.
well, there's an explicitive in there that you mentioned.
Right. We're not mentioning that.
One doctor to another, we'd like to thank Alan for joining us today.
What?
And we'd like to thank Danielle for two.
No, what have you done?
No, Danielle doesn't want to be a doctor, trust me. There's so many headaches.
Danielle dropped out of med school right at the start of it.
Right. So in any event, we'd like to thank Alan for joining us. And join us next week where we will be trying to get another interview with a young woman. Either if not then, if not next week, then the week after, likely. A woman who played a good portion of a couple years dressed as a man.
Wow.
Yes. And she's actually trying to enter the World Series of Poker as a man.
Now, there's something psychological.
Yes.
Exactly. Whatever the words are.
In any event, this is Dr. Nick and... That's your
Alan
cue.
Schoonmaker.
And Dr. Schoonmaker and...
And me.
No, not me. Hot Aussie chick.
Yes, the hot Aussie chick. Yes.
Well, I don't know. I'm starting to think that I should change it to grandma or something. The years have gone by. I'm a veteran now.
Yes, you're still sexy, darling.
Okay.
Oh, thank you, doctor.
Is that your professional opinion, Alan?
No, just my lascivious.
In any event, so we will pick it up next week. This is Dr. Nick and the Hot Aussie Chicks signing off. Aces and faces. Aces and faces. Yes, aces and faces. Bye-bye.
Bye.